But we're going to find they differ also in another way. The whole style, the whole point of the writer is making the Genesis 12 is one thing, and the whole style and the whole point he's making in Genesis 20 is quite another. Both are confessing the same God, but they're making different points. Now what I'm going to do is read to you Genesis 12, 9 to 20, and every once in a while I'll ask you a question. Then Abram journeyed by stages to the Negev. The Negev is that southern part of Palestine. You'll even hear it on modern newscasts, the part down toward the Sinai Peninsula. There was famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarah, "Look, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'She is his wife.' And they will kill me, but they'll let you live because you're so good looking. Please say, therefore, that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me on account of you, and so that I may retain my life thanks to you." Now, here we got to admit that sometimes we can't unpack everything in the text. And I guess nobody has come up yet in the last 2,000 years with a satisfactory reason to explain why it would be that this was came off scot-free. Why does it help to say she's my sister? For some reason, in that country, it would have worked. And maybe you could begin to think, oh, I can figure out why. But it's a kind of a hard question. But it's not very important theologically. But let's look at the question. Number one, did Abraham tell the truth in saying that his wife was his sister? The answer here is probably not. If you just read the Bible, it seems to say that Abraham didn't quite tell the whole truth. He said, we're in a foreign country. Things look pretty dangerous. Why don't you say you're my sister? The father of faith is presented, I think, here as a liar. That doesn't surprise me very much in the Bible. I remember when I was in graduate school in Boston, I had a really delightful Armenian landlord. And he came out on the porch one morning and said, "Ralphie," I didn't like that at all. But he said, "Ralphie," he said, "I saw this movie on TV last night about King David and Bathsheba. What's that doing in the Bible?" That's a good question. And one of the interesting things about Israel is that they told like it really was. David, who is the great king, he's kind of an admirer of everything Israel can hope for in a king, is a murderer and an adulterer as well. There's an expression that occurs very often in the book of Judges, and it says, "The Spirit of the Lord rest upon this person." And then he went out and he whooped somebody pretty good. Of whom is that said the most? Who is it said about most? What judge? Samson. Right. It's also said of Gideon and a few other of the judges, but the one it says the most of that the Spirit of God was upon him was Samson. And sometimes read the stories about Samson in the Bible. He was not a very delightful character. And even though he was hanging around with all these girls and having all these bloodthirsty fights with a Philistine's chair and with an ox jaw and all kinds of sorts of brutal things like this, this man who was in certain respects a great sinner was a person whom God could accept and love and use. And one thing I had to skip tonight she said that to talk about the ambivalent Abraham. Perhaps we can get back to it a little later. That she shows you time after time where Abraham failed. And yet this guy who is constantly failing is the one whom God chooses and the one to whom God shows grace. Yeah, I'm glad the Bible's that way. Because it can really address me because I find myself so often a failure. Now the question is here, Abraham seems to not be telling the whole truth. Number two, is Abraham described as being particularly selfish? I think the answer is yes. He says, Sarah, you got big trouble. They're going to kill me and let you live. So why don't you go off into the harem? And I'll save my life thanks to you. That am chauvinistic. That is really presenting a very insensitive type of situation. And I think the Bible means to say that. But Abraham gets down to Egypt and he has almost immediately forgotten that God said, go from your land and from your country and from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I'm going to make you a great nation. And as soon as there gets to be a famine, down to Egypt he goes, out of the land, which he has just been given. And he doesn't say, oh God, what should we do with this trying situation? Help me to be brave and defend her. Not at all. I think Abraham is presented as rather selfish. Let's go on. When Abraham entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw how very beautiful the woman was. And when Pharaoh's courtiers saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's household. And on account of her, that is, she's taken into Pharaoh's house, on her account, it went very well with Abraham. And he came to own sheep and cattle and he-asses, male and female slaves, she-asses and camels. That's not bad for one woman. It says in the Bible, on account of her, Pharaoh gives her all these gifts. And we see no protest from Abraham. Number six, in Genesis 12, 16, and 20, 14, reference is made to various kinds of animals. Does their different position within the story signify a different meaning? I think one way of reading Genesis 12, verse 16 is to say the animals are a bribe to compensate him for the loss of Sarah. You can ask your questions when I get done with this section. Verse 17, next page. But Yahweh afflicted Pharaoh and his household with extraordinary plagues because of Abram's wife, Sarah. So there we got the whole situation. Abraham has all this livestock and all this money. Sarah is in the palace with Pharaoh. And plague strike. That's all it says. Then Pharaoh summoned Abraham and said, see what you have done to me. Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Question number four. How did the ruler discover that the woman in his court was really the patriarch's wife? Did she type that way? I'd ask the secretary to correct me. I'm not sure it made it. How did the ruler discover that the woman in his court was really the patriarch's wife? The author is really uninterested in telling us. Imagine Pharaoh. Remember how many wives Solomon had? What was it? 300 wives and 700 concubines? Or was it the other way around? I'm not sure. I don't know if it makes any difference. But anyway, you can imagine what Pharaoh would have had. And all of a sudden, plagues hit his house. And he goes tooting up to Abraham and he says, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Now, what might have happened? Maybe you have to read between the lines and say that this time God spoke to Pharaoh and he says, you know, this girl really shouldn't be in this house and you've done wrong and you really ought to go to Abraham and tell him your story. Maybe that all happened. The writer doesn't think it's very important to tell us that. He's interested in some other point. And so I said the author is uninterested in the how of Revelation. You know, in the Lutheran Confessions, there is no statement about Scripture. You know, it's not about original sin. about law and gospel, about justification by faith. There is no paragraph in the Lutheran Confession about Scripture. The reason is, there wasn't a big controversy at that time. I have a feeling that if they were to be written in the 20th century, there might be a little paragraph. But you can see that the time that this is written, it's not a problem. Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now here is your wife, take her and get out of here. Then Pharaoh put men in charge of him and they sent him on his way with his wife and all his possessions. What's the meaning of this story? If you had to teach this story in Sunday school, what would its meaning be? One of the interesting things in Genesis, doesn't he tell you? You have to figure it out for yourself. There's no moral at the end of the story, therefore when you go to Egypt, you know, don't pass your wife off with your sister, or trust in God with all your heart. That might be a kind of good lesson from the story. But what's the meaning of the story? The meaning I get from the story is this. Abraham had just received the promise. He was really instructed by God to be a blessing to other people. To really firmly believe that promise that God gave him, that he would get him land and children. But at the very first opportunity, he trusts in his own pluck. He goes down to Egypt. He treats a foreigner not with an attempt to extend blessings to him, but with an attempt to deceive him. And when I got done reading these materials, I say, Abraham should have listened to the promise. He should have trusted that God who called him and who brought him from Mesopotamia. Instead of that, he was trusting in his own powers. Let me answer the rest of the questions here, and then if there is any question on chapter 12. Number 3, kind of a funny one. Was Sarah kept safe in the ruler's house? That's not a delicate question to discuss here. What happened to Sarah when she was in the palace? There had been plenty of time for Abraham to get all sorts of he asses and she asses and camels. What was Sarah doing? We're not told. The author is uninterested in such gossipy detail. For all I know, she was kept safe. It just is not this writer's concern. Number 5, is Abraham given the title of prophet? Did I say prophet tonight? No. And number 7, what is the overall message of the story in this chapter? Abraham did not live up to his call. He lied, he was selfish, he took a bribe. He is an example of how not to bring blessings to the nations. He is thrown back on the call and on God's promise. Okay, any questions now on chapter 12? Well, I knew there'd be one question I couldn't even begin to answer. If you don't know, Dr. Frank, I don't know who would know.
Well, but I think
we
would say,
we've
glossed over the
And he even can use people like you and me today. Now that's where we begin to hook in. Our sins are less dramatic. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
I think that's exactly what I see being said in this passage. All right, so we get the other part in at least. Let's go on to chapter 20. And I think we're going to see that the concerns are quite a bit different. It begins, Abraham, remember we said his name changed in chapter 17. Abraham journeyed on to the region of the Negev. Back to the Negev again. And he settled between Kadesh and Shur while he was sojourning in Gerar. Abraham said of his wife Sarah, she is my sister. So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God, maybe not a big point, but if you go just left there, you'll see that the other account said Yahweh. This text says God. And one of these strands that Tolkien argued is a penitent, the one we call J, uses the word Yahweh, and the other one that we call E uses the word God. Only one example, and now you're going to see, I think, how the way it approaches a subject is different as well. It's not only that the events happen were somewhat different, it's what the author thought was important to record that we want to look at. God came to Abimelech in a dream one night. Now, isn't that different? Sarah gets hit with plague. He says, by George, Sarah is his wife. God appears to Abimelech in a dream and says to him, you are going to die because of the woman you have taken, for she is a married woman. Abimelech, who had not come near her, asked, oh Lord, would you slay one even though he be innocent? Note the concern with guilt and innocence in this chapter. Sarah was safe. Aren't you relieved? And he's even King Abimelech, a Philistine king. He's praying with God like mad here. And he says, God, I'm innocent. You wouldn't kill me, would you? The fact is that he told me she is my sister. And she herself stated he is my brother. I did it with good faith and with clean hands. God answered him a second time in a dream. Yes. I myself kept you from sinning against me, which is why I would not let you touch her. So that God is watching over the patriarchs here to make sure that nothing happened to them. But you must now return the man's wife. Since he is a prophet, he will intercede for you to save your life. If you do not restore her, know that this means death for you and all yours. Early next morning, Abimelech called all his attendants and told them everything that had happened, and the people were deeply shocked. Then Abimelech summoned Abraham and said to him, see what you have done to us. How did I sin against you that you should have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have behaved toward me in an unforgivable manner. What then, Abimelech demanded of Abraham, was your purpose in doing such a thing? I thought, Abraham replied, there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is in truth my sister. That is, she's my father's daughter, though not my mother's. So she's my half-sister, who became my wife. So when God caused me to wander far from my father's home, I said to her, I want you to do me this kindness. Whatever place we come to, say there of me, he is my brother. Now look, Abimelech got sheep and oxen and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham, and he restored his wife Sarah to him. Said Abimelech, here my land is open to you. Settle wherever you please. To Sarah, he said, I have given your brother 1,000 worth of silver. Let that serve you as a line to the fun. kind word is. Let that serve you as a blinder. That's not even good. Let me just read it. It's not that important a point. Let that serve you as a blind to everybody who is with you. You have been publicly vindicated. Abraham then interceded with God, and God restored full health to Abimelech, namely his wife and his maidservants, so that they could bear again. For God had closed fast every womb in the household of Abimelech on account of Sarah, wife of Abraham. Now let's look at the answer sheet. Number one, did Abraham tell the truth in saying that his wife was his sister? The patriarch was telling the truth. This writer is concerned to present the patriarch as a good model to follow. Is Abraham described as being particularly selfish? Not particularly. He doesn't say something about, I want to save my own life. Number three, was Sarah kept safe in the ruler's house? Yes, God kept Abimelech from sinning, but he didn't even touch Sarah. How did the ruler discover that the woman in his court was really the patriarch's wife? God appears in a dream. He has a long dialogue back and forth between himself and Abimelech. Is Abraham given the title of prophet? Yes, he is. Abraham is a prophet, like Jeremiah was a prophet, or like Isaiah was a prophet, interceding with God to restore and forgive Abimelech. In Genesis 12, 16, and 20, 14, reference is made to various kinds of animals. Does their different position within the story signify a different meaning? Yes. The animals that are given in chapter 20, 14 are given after they've made up. After Abimelech has found out that she really is his wife, he goes back and he rests with Abraham for a while, and he says, how could you do this? And then Abraham said, well, I knew that you folks weren't Lutherans in this place, and I would be afraid that something would happen. And so he says, okay, just to show you that there's no hard feelings, I'm going to give you camels and male and female slaves, and he asses and she asses and all sorts of things. As a nice goodwill gesture. That is, these animals play a completely different function in this story. What is the overall message of the story in this chapter? I think the lesson here could be summarized this way. Abraham is a good example of what a child of God should be. He is truthful. He is not selfish. He's a prophet who prays for his enemies. And this story supplies the answer to exactly how God communicates with people. That is, the second chapter is interested in questions like ethics. How God reveals himself to his people through dreams, through discussion. My point is here now, we have two very similar stories, and the theology that's built upon them has really totally different emphases. They are both testimonies to the same God, so I think you see with quite different results. Okay. What questions do you have now on the basis of this? Sir?
You claim that Abraham spoke the truth in chapter 20, verse 5.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, his intent was to deceive, was it not?
Right.
How do you acquire deception
with truth? Well, it's a best of half truth. You know, I think it's a little forced situation. Abraham is trying to say, I was telling you the truth, even though we might not be convinced. But I think what this writer is trying to say, Abraham didn't really lie, but I think he's embarrassed by it.
Who's embarrassed by it? The writer.
Yeah.
This is not, he refers to this chapter 20 as something
with
reference to ethics.
Right.
This is not an ethic to be recommended.
This is what he did here. I guess I would not say so. But I think the man is trying to give a better picture of Abraham than the one we have in chapter 12. And we are told that, after all, some people might say, do you mean that Sarah lived in this king's house for all this time? Was she really a loose woman? And that comes out even clearer. No, she did. She was safe. I don't know what she was doing in there. Maybe it's like Mary knitting all the time or something. All right. but she was kept safe there. But it also tries to say Abraham was not the kind of guy who lied. But I think you see the tension. We still are kind of reminded of what we were told in chapter 12.
Well, I'm reminded of another incident in Genesis that has to do, I think it's Genesis, can't begin anyhow, of the wives of Egypt, who almost immediately after the remnants of their lying or deception took place, the writer indicates that God blessed them. And this has been a matter of question. Why were they blessed? Or at least why does the writer indicate so immediately after that that God blessed them? Is there a difference between deception and truth? Between deception and lying?
I suppose there is. I'm sure there is. Those midwives there were trying, you know, when you come to a desperate situation, sometimes you'll do desperate things, in the name of God. And Lucian Pastis, for example, tried to assassinate Adolf Hitler. I guess I would not have been among them, but I do not criticize them. We can see how in a very desperate situation, when a man is exterminating Jewish people and waging a horrendous war, you might say God wants me to stop this man somehow. And if you're in Egypt and the whole nation is about to get wiped out, you may do something very questionable in order to try to remain faithful to God. Let me tell you another story that's in Genesis. We're not going to get much farther than this anyway. It's my favorite story in Genesis. And it's the one they never told you in Sunday school. And it's the story about Judah, and he has three sons. Now, their names are Er, Onan, and the third son, I guess, was named Shelah. Story in Genesis 38. And Er gets married to this nice young gal. And he dies first night. So in the Old Testament, when a man died, his brother had to marry the widow and raise up sons in his brother's name, so-called levirate marriage. So Onan gets married, and God gets angry at him for one reason or another, and God kills him shortly after they've been married. And this gal's name, who's marrying all these guys, her name is Tamar. So she marries him, he dies. She marries him, he dies. She says, next. And Judah says, just a minute. Now, I don't like what's happening with you. This guy's a little boy. You ought to really let him grow up first. And he's obviously dodgy. So, years pass. One day, Judah goes out on a business trip. And he comes to this city, and he meets a prostitute. And he has relations with her. And as he's getting ready to leave, he says, do you take master charge? And she says, no. He says, well, I'm fresh out of cash, but would you take my ring and my staff? So he goes home. Sends a servant back and says, get my ring back. And the servant goes around the town and says, have you seen this lady of the night? Is she anywhere around here? Never heard of any lady of the night. No lady of the night in this town. Comes back home to Judah, and Judah says, well, let's not take out an ad in the Post-Dispatch. Let's just forget about it. Well, we didn't recognize Tamar. A couple months passed. When the servants come up, came up to him and said, "Hey, Judah, remember that no good Tamar?"
"Oh, yeah, I remember her all right.
She's pregnant. That dirty old girl. She's an adulteress. You know what we do with adulteresses in this town, don't you? We burn her. Take her out to be burned." So to take her out to be burned. And she says, "Oh, by the way, the father of this child gave me this ring, there's belonging to Judah on it, and this staff." That really is a poignant story. Judah says, and this is the punchline, Judah says, "You are more righteous than I." Now, according to our usual definition of the word righteousness, she's splitting hairs, is that? Why, she's a prostitute bearing an illegitimate baby. Well, you know, he was a philanderer and all this kind of thing, or whatever you call that, but, you know, who's better and who's worse? She was a prostitute. But he says, "You are more righteous than I." Why did he say this? Because he said she was so faithful to her first husband that she was willing to do literally anything to make sure she would have a child. Tamar, you are more righteous than I am. Now that story doesn't mean to say that's what you ought to do. It means to tell us what the meaning of God's righteousness is. Now, Luther wrestled with this question. What does it mean, God is righteous? He says, does it mean that God is like a righteous judge who sits with sinners and drops them off into a lake of fire? Is that the righteousness of God? Luther said, and he could have just got his meaning of righteousness from this story, the righteousness of God means that God is so faithful to his people that he will do anything. He will stop at no length to make sure that relationship is maintained. The righteousness of God, then, Luther said, it doesn't mean that God keeps the Ten Commandments. The righteousness of God means that God sent his only Son. Now, here you have, you know, point of telling this story is that this is such an unsavory story. We're almost uncomfortable with the word. And yet it's a beautiful example of what righteousness is. It's a nice tip-off for us to say is God is righteous that way, only with a capital R. So faithful is God to his people that even when they rebuff him with their sins and with their doubts and with their broken communities, he shows his love. Okay, other questions on this point? Sure.
It's anticlimactic after that, but I think it's worth noting that when Abimelech sends Sarah on her way, he says, "I have given your brother the power of silver."
take it as a personal reference to anybody here, really.
Any other questions? God is always popping up in the same way, isn't he? You know, this chapter, this sheet here on the ambivalent Abraham, maybe I can kind of close by just hurriedly rushing through that sheet. I can't say everything I wanted to say. It'd take an hour or so, but I can say a few things. The one that says at the top of it, faithfulness and failure, the ambivalent Abraham. These are stories about Abraham that contained in this document. And they constantly show a back and forth between the promise being given to Abraham and him either acting faithfully or him acting faithlessly. So that I would say the first thing I would want to write down at the top of that page is I had made a column in my page right down the middle, Genesis 12:1-3, God's elected promise. And the first thing that Abraham does then is that he leaves Mesopotamia. That's a faithful thing to do. That's what he should have done. But then in chapter 12, verse 10, God repeats the promise. And how do we see Abraham act in this case? He leaves the land and goes down to Egypt, and he deceives Pharaoh to save his own neck. In chapter 13, verse 15, God repeats the promise, and we find that what happens here is that Abraham rescues Lot. And when he gets done rescuing Lot, this king Abimelech comes out to him in chapter 14:18-20, and he repeats the promise to Abraham. And what does Abraham do in chapter 15? What he plans to make his slave, his heir. That is, he says, God can't do it. God really can't give me a son. He doesn't believe the promise. Then comes that beautiful passage, which we all know, where God takes him outside, shows him all the stars, and he says, Abraham, if you just believe me, you'd have as many children as there are stars. And then we're told, Abraham believes God. Abraham believed that promise, even though he was a very old man. God considered him righteous. And then in the very next verses, chapter 15:7 and following, we have a magnificent covenant ceremony where God said, Abraham, I'm making this covenant with you, and I will bless you. And the next thing that happened is that Abraham and Sarah said, nah, God's not going to be able to do it. He's just going to cop out on that promise. We've got to take this girl, Hagar, and have a child by her. Okay, I can't do the whole thing. I think you can see the pattern that just begins to unfold. The promise, you're right, sir, keeps popping up again and again, another half dozen times on this page. Sometimes we see that faith is really kindled in Abraham, and sometimes he acts in a very sinful way. Until there is one thing I want to say, that at the birth of Isaac in chapter 21, and it says that again in chapter 24, verse 7, we find that Abraham finally receives the promise. He's been promised seed, and sure enough, Isaac is born. It must have been a happy day. Chapter 24, 7 says, and Yahweh blessed Abraham and everything. Abraham sends a servant to get a wife because he doesn't want one of these Israelite girls from Canaan. He wants a good God-fearing wife. And he wants 11 out to get a wife, he said, "Oh, I know that that gal might want to stay up there in Mesopotamia, live up there in the suburbs. She's got to come back home here to Palestine. If she won't come, stay up there." So he protects the seed and the land. And get over Rebecca. You remember how bad Sarah is in the Bible? When God says to Sarah, "You're going to have a child," she laughs. When they said to Sarah, when they said to Rebecca, "What do you want to do?" she said, "Let's go." And finally, we find Abraham at the end of his life. He gets married again. He has six more sons. But before he dies, he does two things. He says, "You six sons, I love you. Here's some presents, but you've got to get out of the land." And finally, just before he dies, he says to Isaac, "The land is yours." And so we find that as the writer has summarized this picture of Abraham, he could have no way included everything out of 175 years of Abraham's life. What he does show is that how Abraham reacted with faithfulness and faithlessness to the promise. And how the goal of this is finally that is to lead to that kind of godly, obedient life that we find at the end of this material. What God's desire is for each one of us, that we might hear this call of Abraham and say, "Now we who receive so much more, not just the promise of land and seed, but Jesus Christ himself, what can I do tomorrow morning to see how I can extend God's blessing to the people I meet?" God loves you very much.